So I'm going to present the results of some recent studies investigating the structure of the inner core. Some of you will have seen this already because you came to see my poster, but now I have a captive audience, so I can talk at you for even longer and give you even more details. And I'm going to use these results to work out what the inner core is composed of and how it grew. Seismic study has revealed increasing complexity in inner core structure. The outer part of the inner core has clearly defined hemispheres with different isotropic velocities. The eastern hemisphere is seismically fast and the western hemisphere is seismically slow. And then below this layer, the inner core is anisotropic, with waves propagating faster parallel to the rotation axis than in the equatorial plane. This is often parameterized as axisymmetric anisotropy, where the fast axis is aligned with the rotation axis. And this too shows hemisphericity, although here the western hemisphere is the one that's fast and the eastern hemisphere is slow. And there may also be contrasts in attenuation between the two different hemispheres, and there's been suggestions of a distinct innermost inner core. Anisotropy can be interpreted as some kind of alignment, either shape preferred or lattice preferred. And assuming that the inner core doesn't contain aligned tubes of melt, we can instead use the anisotropy to infer which phase of iron, in terms of HCP, BCC, and so forth, could be stable in the inner core. And anisotropy requires some mechanism of generating alignment. Observing evidence of accumulated deformation may tell us about how the inner core grew and developed. And this inferred growth history will have implications for the power source of the geodynamo. In this talk, I will address several questions about the inner core, starting with trying to work out where in the Earth the seismic anomalies are coming from, and whether we can attribute them to the inner core. Next, I will assess the distribution of anisotropy, including addressing the question of the existence of an innermost inner core. And finally, I will follow in the traditions of SIDA and connect my work in seismology with that of the other disciplines, in particular mineral physics and geodynamics, in an attempt to understand how the inner core actually behaves. The inner core can be studied seismically using a range of different methods, including core-sensitive normal modes, seismic interferometry, and body waves. And the majority of the structures that I've just described have been studied using body waves. And this is what I'll focus on here. I will use the core wave PKP, which comprises the outer core branches PKP AB and BC, and then the inner core branch PKP DF. Confusingly, these phases can also be referred to as PKP for the two outer core phases and PK IKP, not to be confused with PK little IKP, for the inner core phase. The paths are characterized by the angle xi that the inner core part of the path makes of the rotation axis, where xi angles below about 35 degrees are classed as being polar, and anything greater than 35 degrees, so this kind of direction, is classed as equatorial. We measure travel times relative to some 1D reference model, and to account for structure outside of our region of interest, we use differential travel times. The rationale, so this is comparing the outer core phase to the inner core phase. The rationale being that both phases would be similarly affected by structure in the mantle, where their paths are similar, but only the inner core phase only the inner core phase PKPDF samples the inner core. Therefore, if we difference the travel time anomalies of the two phases, the remaining anomaly will be due to the inner core. The path of PKPBC is very similar to that of PKPDF, while PKPAB, the blue phase, is further away. So we assume that PKP BC DF differentials are more reliable. In this example, on the right, the inner core phase PKP DF arrives about 8 seconds early, marked by this red line. And that's 8 seconds prior to the prediction, marked by the black line. Meanwhile, the outer core phase PKP AB arrives at the time that's predicted by the 1D model, suggesting that PKP DF is being influenced by some faster structure, which we assume to be in the inner core. To date, studies of the inner core have struggled from the point of limited source-receiver pairs at polar angles. We only have earthquakes in certain locations, and we can only place stations where there's land. And given the low number of high-latitude sources and receivers, most of the inner core work has relied on the relatively frequent earthquakes from the South Sandwich Islands, down here, observed at stations in Alaska. The resulting models of anisotropy often require about 4% maximum velocity anomaly. The black points shown here mark one of these models. And you can see that they fit the data well for the more equatorial data well, don't fit this data in the middle very well, and are constrained at the top end by the South Sandwich Islands to Alaska data. Beyond that, there have not been many constraints at the more polar angles. To address this, I have taken advantage of more recent temporary deployments in Antarctica and the expanding US array in Alaska. I also made a few more equatorial measurements between sources and receivers in Southeast Asia and Central America, and I'll talk more about these later. In the data set, we have good global distribution and global coverage, and most importantly, a lot of our polar observations come from paths that are independent of the South Sandwich Islands to Alaska path, but instead are from these few rare events up in the Northern Hemisphere observed at stations in Antarctica. And here I'm showing my travel time measurements for just the best quality picks displayed as travel time anomaly as a function of this polar angle xi. And there's a lot of information in this plot which I will start going through to start unpacking to try and answer some of my questions. The first question being, is this travel time anomaly actually coming from the inner core? This is the same data as before, but now I'm highlighting the data observed at stations in Alaska in green, with measurements from earthquakes in Alaska but observed at stations in Antarctica in purple. I've also plotted a new anisotropy curve in the dark red, in the light red, that's fit without the data from Alaska. And this requires much lower anisotropy. And the green data covers a very large range in travel time anomalies for a very small range of polar angles. Meanwhile, the purple data from the sources in Alaska better fits the global pattern. This can be seen even more clearly when we just look at the PKP BC minus DF differentials. The majority of these require relatively low travel time, relatively low travel time anomaly, requiring relatively weak anisotropy to fit, except for this data observed at stations in Alaska. And when viewed in a map, we can see a spatial correlation between the region of high travel time anomalies in red and the location of the Alaskan slab from a recent tomography model shown by the blue contour. We can make predictions of the differential travel time anomaly using ray tracing through a tomographic model, and predict a similar pattern of travel time anomalies with larger travel time anomalies over the slab, albeit at much lower magnitudes. This is related to the fact that tomography models tend to be a damped version of observed travel time anomalies. Oh, sorry, of the mantle structure. Now plotting the rays both in map view and in cross-section, we can see why the data from sources in Alaska at stations in Antarctica might better fit the global pattern and not be affected by this structure. These paths very rapidly leave the slab to the south, the slab is dipping to the north. Meanwhile, the data observed at stations in Alaska comes in from this direction, traversing the whole of the slab. And differential measurement is assumed to account for the upper mantle structure, but 3D ray tracing and waveform modeling shows that in regions of very strong heterogeneity, such as around slabs, even very small differences in angle relative to the heterogeneity can result in large differences in path and result in large differences in travel time. Just to explain this, the black lines are paths expected from a 1D velocity model, but if you 3D ray trace through this tomographic model, you end up with the green paths. So the substantial difference between what you'd expect if you were just ray tracing through 1D is if you're ray tracing through something with actual heterogeneities. And so for now, we just have to conclude that the travel time anomalies measured in Alaska are contaminated and not fully representative of the inner core structure. And so from now on, I will exclude them from the rest of the data set. The influence of the Alaskan slab will be explored in more detail, but this is a project that I'm just about to start. So this follows on to my second question of how the anisotropy is distributed within the inner core. A purely axisymmetric anisotropic Earth would show a smooth curve of anisotropy with relatively little scatter resulting from measurement error. Removing the South Sandwich Islands data removes some of the spread of travel time anomalies, but the scatter still remains, especially for the polar data. It's a large range of travel time anomalies over a small range in Z-angle. And this hints at other regional patterns. The magnitude of the travel time anomaly varies as a function of longitude, which is a pattern which has been observed before. And this has been attributed to a hemispherical dichotomy that the Western Hemisphere shows larger travel time anomalies than the Eastern Hemisphere. Here I have found the best fitting location of the Western Hemisphere, at western edge of the Western Hemisphere, but this eastern band is taken from Jessica Irving's results, which are far better constrained than these are. The anisotropy in the Western Hemisphere is stronger than that in the Eastern Hemisphere, and splitting the data into these two hemispheres can explain some of the scatter at the polar angles. The Western Hemisphere is shown in red, the Eastern Hemisphere in blue. Nonetheless, at the most polar angles, the travel time anomaly remains spread over several seconds, even within each hemisphere. I consider now just the polar data, just the data traveling within about 15 degrees of the rotation axis, and plot this as a function of distance between the source and the receiver. And this function of distance is equivalent to the depth into the inner core of the ray sample. The further away the source and the receiver are, the deeper it travels into the inner core. The travel time anomaly increases linearly as a function of distance or depth in the inner core. And this is true for both the Western Hemisphere in red and the Eastern Hemisphere in blue. And some of this increase will result from increasing path length in the inner core as a function of distance. But when we normalize the travel time anomaly for the time spent in the inner core, effectively converting it to a velocity anomaly, we still end up with this pattern of increasing velocity anomaly as a function of distance and depth, thus indicating that the magnitude of anisotropy depends on depth into the inner core. On the subject of depth in the inner core, I will address the question of whether a distinct innermost inner core actually exists. So this is an idea that's been discussed for a while, with various studies disagreeing over the size and also the character of anisotropy within a distinct innermost inner core, and whether the boundary between the two would be sharp or gradational. The most recent work is suggests an innermost inner core with the axis of anisotropy inclined almost parallel to the equator, inclined close to the equator, within 9 degrees of the equator. This result was derived from observations made using CODA correlation, or seismic interferometry. And that's not a method I'll talk more about. But it's important to note it's a different method from body wave analysis. And the seismically distinct, a seismically distinct innermost inner core would have profound implications for how the inner core had been growing. And this particular model of an inclined axis of anisotropy suggests maybe even a rotation of the inner core within or relative to the whole Earth. A two-layer model such as this would produce a pattern of anisotropy that we could see at the surface of the inner core. There would be slower regions in two rings around Southeast Asia and Southeast Asia and Central America, and then higher velocity anomalies at the poles. And this is in contrast to a simple axisymmetric model, where you would have stronger anisotropy at the poles and less at the equator. As I mentioned earlier, I collected data from events in Southeast Asia and Central America, sampling the fast direction from this inclined innermost inner core model. After correcting for the outer inner core, I transformed the data into xi relative to this inclined axis of rotation. Inclined axis of anisotropy. And this is the axis that produces the best fit for this particular for the study that I'm referring to. The red data, which are their observations, are well fit by the red line. However, for my observations, this produces pretty awful fit, and it dramatically increases the scatter, particularly around this area. And this implies that my data cannot be fit by an axisymmetric anisotropy model with the axis inclined to the inclined to the rotation axis parallel with the equator. Instead, my data is far better fit by just a standard model of anisotropy where the axis aligned with the rotation axis. Still, placing the axis of anisotropy at the rotation axis is just a convenient assumption that we tend to use. Using the new data set and with the South Sandwich Islands data excluded, I grid searched to find the best fitting axis of anisotropy. I test a two-layer model and fit the axis of anisotropy in the innermost inner core, and then also a one-layer model and fit the axis of anisotropy in the whole Earth. In both cases, the best fitting axis of anisotropy is within about 10 degrees of the rotation axis. And this is very similar to that found by Jessica Irving in a previous study. So is the idea of an innermost inner core dead? Well, my data don't require it. That's all I can say. They don't require a distinct layer in the deep inner core, a deep part of the Earth, and definitely don't require strongly inclined anisotropy. But we now need to understand why the two different methods would disagree. Although, going back to the observations, I actually think the red data can be relatively well fit by the black line, or maybe with some understanding of what the difference between the methods is. So this leads me to a final question of how we can interpret these seismic observations in the context of Earth's composition and behavior. To explain the previous observations, I propose three seismically derived models of inner core anisotropy. First, a bulk hemispherical model, with the Western Hemisphere having a fixed but stronger anisotropy than the Eastern Hemisphere. Secondly, a radially dependent model where the anisotropy increases as a function of depth. The western and eastern hemisphere are both different, but in the center, the western and eastern hemisphere have about the same anisotropy. And then finally, an axially dependent model where magnitude of anisotropy depends not on depth, but on distance, lateral distance from an axis aligned with the rotation axis, but in this case offset by about 400 kilometers into the western hemisphere. We consider the predicted velocity anomalies of these two these models shown by the dashed lines and compare these with the observations shown by the solid lines. And both the radial model and the axially dependent model fit the observations relatively well, or statistically both fit the observations to about the same degree. However, there is a problem with the depth-dependent model, such that once you have the shallow turning data require weak anisotropy in the upper part. So if you fit that into your model, then the deep turning data that require stronger anisotropy end up amplifying your anisotropy. So you end up with weak anisotropy in the outer layer and very, very strong anisotropy in the inner layer to fit the observations overall. This ends up being about 6%, which implies nearly 100% alignment of iron crystals in the inner core, which seems unrealistic. Alternatively, that's why we prefer the model of axial anisotropy, which requires much weaker degrees of anisotropy to fit. And like I said, the axis of anisotropy, of strongest anisotropy, is slightly offset into the lower part of the western hemisphere. And there is evidence of depth variation in the character of anisotropy as well. The deeper into the inner core you go, or the rays turn, the stronger the slow direction of anisotropy becomes. That's contrasting the depth of this part of the curve to the point at the equator. And the orientation, slow axis, slow about 60 degrees throughout. And we can use this information to infer the structure of the inner core. Results from mineral physics experiments and calculations predict the pattern of anisotropy for iron at core conditions. This curve shows the expected anisotropy for HCP iron at 3,000 degrees and 300 GPA. And this is calculated for a single crystal. In contrast, aggregate crystals with non-ideal alignment would result in this curve, where the magnitude of anisotropy is less and the depth of the curvature, so the amplitude of the slow direction, is also less. And so this observation could be interpreted as evidence that the alignment, the degree of alignment of iron crystals, is increasing as a function of depth. Various models are producing alignment of iron crystals and thus anisotropy in the inner core has been suggested. In this Yoshida model, column convection in the outer core would preferentially extract heat in the equatorial direction. This would cause faster crystallization at the equator, resulting in an oblate inner core. But isostatic adjustment to make a spherical inner core again would result in the equator flowing in and up towards the poles, thus driving deformation stress in the inner core. This flow, combined with prismatic slip on the C plus A plane in HCP iron, would flow the crystals to be aligned with the rotation axis, potentially producing anisotropy in the inner core that we could then observe seismically. Meanwhile, it was suggested that the hemispherical pattern in the upper part of the inner core derives from lateral translation of the inner core, with it growing on one side and melting on the other side. This was tested in a past slider to see if it would be possible to develop sharp hemispherical boundaries in the inner core in this way. And it suggests that the result was that, yes, you can do that. So this would fit the upper inner core. To create both axial anisotropy aligned with the rotation axis and offset with the strongest anisotropy offset into the western hemisphere, I propose a combined model of inner core convection and lateral translation. And with the help of Marine LeBlay and her Grow Your IC code, which was also related to SIDA, we can show that combining these dynamic processes would result in strong accumulated deformation offset from the rotation axis. So what remains is to choose a set of elastic parameters for iron, choose a slip system, and model the development of anisotropy in the inner core due to flow using VPSC. I can then ray trace through the model to predict the travel time anomalies that I observed and compare these with my observations. And this down here, showing predictions and observations, is a placeholder figure for when I actually do it correctly, because when I was at SETI, I was told I was doing it wrong. So that will be updated the next time you see this talk. So to conclude, the upper mantle can contaminate deeper data, and we need to be careful when we're assigning the travel time anomalies to the inner core. Previous models likely overestimated the anisotropy in the upper part of the inner core as a result of the contamination. And our new data could be well fit by two models, but we prefer the model where the magnitude of anisotropy depends on axial distance from the rotation axis. And it's likely that the inner core comprises HCP iron, and it's plausible that it grew through a combination of translation and convection. And before I take questions, I will just put up this figure from a book by Bowen, which I'll let you read because I find it quite amusing. See, everyone's eyes still focused on the screen.
So I'll ask a question there. I mean, one of the challenges with both of those flow models is the possibility of stratification in the uniform, right? Both the translation and also the relaxation associated with lacticity would be strongly affected by thermal, any kind of stratification. And so this will ultimately be related back to the thermal evolution of the core, right?
Yes.
But that is at least a concern about the flow patterns that you would get with both of those mechanisms.
I have a question. If you go back, you showed that PKPBC minus PKPDF seems to, so when you throw out the AD path, seems to show almost no dependence on Xi.
Yep.
Which is really cool. But that's so weird.
So it is...
Oh, there! Yep. Look, beautiful. No intercore anisotropy, let's not worry about it.
So the BC paths are only sensitive to the shallowest part of the inner core.
Yeah, because you can't go through the... So what do you... But aren't the AB paths the mantle legs of and the core entry point of PKPAB is much more different to DF than BC is
yep.
to DF?
Yeah.
How much of a problem do you think that is, or how much of can that introduce in terms of travel time anomaly?
So I'll finish the other question first, that BC is just traveling very shallowly in the inner core. So it implies that the shallow part of the inner core requires less anisotropy. It's only the deeper part of the inner core, when you go to the AB data, that it requires more anisotropy. As in response to your second question of the difference in the paths, yes, it is very much the case that when you get further apart or longer source receiver distances, the core entry points the DF, the inner core phase, and AB, the outer core phase, are a long way apart, at most 30 degrees. And the AB path does spend a lot of time in the deeable prime layer. I think it's like 600 kilometers, a significant amount of its path. So it could accumulate a lot of anomaly. But we do see some travel time anomaly related to mantle structure. So here I'm showing the differential travel time anomalies relative to tomographic corrections for MIT P08. I've tried 10 different models, a few P models and a few S models, scaled P models, and a few S models and P models amplified. But the pattern is the same of slightly increasing travel time anomaly, equivalent while the predicted travel time anomaly from the tomography is also increasing. So yes, there is a dependence. However, that's for the AB minus DF data. However, you can sort of remove that by looking at just the PKPDF absolute times. So now you're not comparing a differential measurement. You're just saying how much faster is DF relative to the 1D model. And here you remove that almost completely remove that dependence. The R value, not always a great measure, but in this case, you're removing that dependence. So yes, there is that. That is a problem, but the magnitude of the problem is very small. The magnitude of the effect of the mantle is very small in most cases, but not in all cases. At the same time, we do need to be very aware of it. Mantle corrections are a good start. 3D ray trace mantle corrections are even better.
So if I look at this figure on the left, sorry. Should I interpret it as that the mantle signal can be about half of the core signal
It can be about, no, it's not going to be half the signal. It's going to be about plus minus 1 second.
And then at the bottom it says PKPABDF differential charge.
Yeah. So the mantle signature on this side is about plus minus 1 second.
And the core is and the total is plus or minus 2 seconds.
Yes. Okay. So there's some combination of measurement error and some combination of mantle signature. But plus minus 1 second, even if it's plus minus 2 seconds, is still smaller than the magnitude of the signal that we see. So it's important to be aware of, but it's not going to completely destroy the signal. Peter was next.
Can you go to the convection models?
Yeah. This one?
No, to the right. That one. So how can you have translation if you have heat? If you have convection, you have heat leaving both equators or both hemispheres, then how would you get the translation? Because you need heat going in to melt.
It would have to be some difference between the two hemispheres, some difference between the two sides. I can't say that I have fully worked through the physical ramifications of such a model, or where you would necessarily get the forcings to do this from. As an arm wavy thing, I could say the mantle, but that's not. I haven't actually mantle control and co-mantle boundary heat flux, but I haven't worked that through. So it would still be, I think it would still be possible to get the translation, but you need a different degree of heat being lost on one side to the other side.
I use the convection, I always thought you have heat leaving both sides, you wouldn't have any melting.
With which convection?
In a poor convection, like what you have here.
There is heat loss on some sides, there would be greater heat loss on one side relative to the other.
I have a related question, I guess I can also answer this question. Translation is just another regime of convection where heat flow is basically accommodated by melting and refreezing, so that makes kind of convection easier because you don't have to go around the corner, you don't have a problem of viscous dissipation due to corner flow anymore. But here I'm wondering, you have two regimes of translation, right? One regime where you have a degree 2 translation,
yep,
which is mm-hmm. Lico et al., and
yep,
then the degree 1 translation.
Yep.
And then on the next slide, you're showing a Marin's result where you have the combination of the two. I don't really see how you can get a combination of the two. Do you know under which kind of boundary conditions and in which parameter range this is possible, or maybe a first Marin?
You would have to ask Marin for a good answer. I can give you a not so good answer. Which is that she is imposing the model of W. Yoshida, which is greater heat loss here, and thus flow back in, greater growth and flow back into the inner core and up, and at the same time moving everything, advecting everything to the side.
Okay, so she's actually imposing this combination of 2 degrees of translation. It's
yes.
Not self-consistently arising out of the
no.
boundary conditions.
No. Yes.
I have quite a lot of questions, but I'm going to stick to two because more is me. Very specifically for this, you're combining what is essentially a rigid body translation on the right-hand side of the previous screen with an inner core which is deforming because it's the easiest way to do it. So is there a sweet spot for the viscosity of the inner core that if this was true, you would have pinned down? Because this is basically solid, not deformed at all, and that's really
yes.
having to deform a lot over the edge of the inner core to create any degree of crystal alignment.
Yeah.
It's my favorite story, but I don't know if you can have the right viscosity for this. So if these are both true, can you pin down viscosity in the inner core?
Potentially, but again, I haven't necessarily thought through the physical ramifications of this. Yes, I know that the inner core convection model requires isostatic adjustment of a viscous body. Like you say, that's rigid translation. Potentially there is some regime under which both can be true, but I haven't looked at the magnitudes of the forcings in each to be able to answer that correctly.
And my other question is slightly specific, which is the South Sandwich Island data has always been problematic.
Yep.
And when you pick it, it does seem to have those big differential travel times.
Oh, yeah.
And you said we could discard them because if you looked at Antarctic observations of Alaskan earthquakes, they were different. But where do those go through the inner core? Do they go through different bits of the inner core or the same bits of the inner core?
Almost the same. Not exactly the same, but almost the same. So, I have other data from a different method that has the same observation, that if you go through the South Sandwich to Alaska path, you end up with large travel time anomalies. And that's the PPRAM data that's completely independent sources, just happens to have the same path through the inner core, which reinforces my idea that there's something about that path, potentially the receivers in Alaska, that are the problem. I'm discarding it for now because it's too complicated for me to want to work with at this moment. There is most definitely still an inner core signature in there. What would be more satisfying is to look at the, at least I hope it is, look at the, this is a function of depth. So when you're just looking at the stuff, stuff that's sampling the shallow part of the inner core, where the South Sandwich Islands are, they're still sticking out. They're giving you a different signature. But at the same time, there is still some degree of anisotropy. So there is some anisotropy that these are sensitive to. But then there's something else on top of that that's causing an extra degree of anomaly.
And those numbers on your purple line match what I see under Africa with an order of magnitude.
Okay.
That might be the
global story. Okay, Dan, thanks very much.
Okay.
Appreciate that.